Welcome to Better Cybersecurity, the ISF podcast. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ISF Chief Executive Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve sits down with Dr. Helena Boschke, globally acclaimed psychologist, to talk about the best security system of all, the human brain. The two discuss how stress impacts performance in high-stakes environments like cybersecurity, why trust and psychological safety matter more than ever, and what leaders can do to help their team stay calm, focused, and creative, even when the pressure is on. Dr. Boschke also explains the neuroscience that proves how we can train our brains to become more cyber-resilient.
Today we're going to talk about something a little different, perhaps on the podcast, but it is sometimes unpredictable, sometimes the best security system of all, and that's the human brain. And with me to talk about that is Helena Boschke. Helena is a psychologist and neuroscientist who's spent years studying how our brains respond to stress, change, and uncertainty, and what that means for how we lead, learn, and make decisions. We'll talk about how stress impacts performance in high-stakes environments like cybersecurity, why trust and psychological safety matter more than ever, and what leaders can do to help their teams stay calm, focused, and creative, even when the pressure's on. Helena, wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much for joining me in the studio today.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Let's start with a little bit of neuroscience. Cybersecurity teams often operate in a constant state of alert. They have to deal with threats, pressure, uncertainty. From a neuroscience perspective, what actually happens to our brains under that kind of sustained stress?
There's a lot of work that's being done on stress now because people do feel very stressed in the world we're in anyway. Mm-hmm. But when we're in a state of stress, the body switches on to become very alert to what's going on around them. And what happens is that we activate a system called the sympathetic nervous system, which we commonly know as fight or flight.
Right.
And this switches the brain on by pumping noradrenaline. It's a chemical we have, and this is quite pervasive in the brain. And the first sign of noradrenaline is the pupils dilate to take in more visual information. So the pupils open up, the heartbeat quickens, we release glucose, we pump blood to the hands and the feet, our digestion stops, and we're in a state of arousal. And it's called sympathetic nervous system because we become sympathetic to the world around us. So if the world feels out of whack or frightening or threatening, we activate a system that sympathizes with that. And this is the state that we are not designed to be in all the time. We're designed to switch it on and switch it off very quickly. The problem with the modern world is that we are leaving it switched on for too long. And this is playing havoc with our other systems, because as well as the sympathetic nervous system, we activate another stress system, which doesn't commonly get talked about, but this is called the HPA axis. It's the hypothalamic pituitary axis. And this axis releases cortisol. So the sympathetic nervous system releases adrenaline and noradrenaline in the brain. Adrenaline is released from the adrenal gland, and the HPA axis releases cortisol from the adrenal gland as well, a slightly different part. Now, cortisol, when it stays in our system for too long, it works a bit like hydrocortisone cream, which is a synthetic form of cortisol, and it's designed to suppress our immune system because with activation of a stress response comes inflammation. Cortisol is there to suppress that inflammation. Now, if we leave cortisol in the system, we start to suppress other things. So our glucose, our blood sugar goes a bit all over the place. We affect our tissue repair. It can lead to all kinds of other problems like heart disease, cancers, even insulin resistance. So we've got to be very aware that as we're activating our stress response over and over again, we're leaving chemicals in the system that we're not designed to leave.
So from a layman's perspective,
yes.
How do I spot that? So let's say I've got a team working in a SOC, very high stress environment, lots of things going on. I'm the team lead. How do I spot those things and what can I do?
It's very difficult to spot straight away. The early warning signs of stress are very interesting and they're normally cognitive.
Right.
So you have cognitive warning signs, you've got emotional warning signs, behavioral and physical. But the early warning signs are normally cognitive, and it normally involves memory loss. So people start to forget things. They suffer from what's called cognitive failures. They become more absent-minded, or they struggle to make decisions. And that's often a sign that the system is now in a state of stress and needs to calm itself down, because we need to actively bring online the opposite system, which is called the parasympathetic mode, which we're designed to be in, otherwise right. known as rest and digest. Mm-hmm. So cognitive warning signs are early behavioral and emotional ones, prone to outbursts of emotion, feeling overwhelmed by the world we're in, feeling that we can't cope, feeling that we get irritable with other people. Those are all signs that the stress system is in operation, probably for too long. So we need to take stock. And if you can see that, if people start behaving in a much more emotional way than normal, mm-hmm. or they're struggling to make decisions, or they're a bit absent-minded, time for leaders to say, let's just take a pause and let's think about what's going on. By the time these warning signs have spilled over into physical and behavioral ones, it's normally then almost too late. Then we look for signs of burnout. People start to develop habits that aren't helpful to them. And then people then become absent because lots of other things are going on inside them. The stomach starts to get very upset. You don't sleep. And then it has a terrible knock-on effect. So spotting early warning signs is a really important thing a leader can do.
And I suppose as well, planning for those things. So one of the things that people tell me when a breach happens, when an attack happens, obviously, it's over a very sustained period of time, yes. normally in terms of trying to rectify the situation. There's a reluctance for some of the team to actually leave the job. So they want to stick at it. They want to continue to do it. So building in almost enforced rest, yeah. enforced breaks.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's something that needs to be practiced, rehearsed, yes. so that it's not seen as a sign of weakness.
No, not at all. And it's absolutely key people do that. It's about putting the break in before the perceived need for it. Because by the time right. the perceived need is very apparent, it's often too late. Right. So then the person is really struggling with the whole systems. So spotting those signs early, but building in breaks even before you think you need it. Making sure that what we tend to do is to store up our breaks for after the month period or the 2 month period. And that can be a very long time to be stressed. We're not designed, we're designed to be fight the bear, fight the tiger, and then rest. Right. It's acute. We're designed to switch it on, switch it off. We're not designed to be in this constant state of alertness. And if we are in a constant state of alertness, the other thing we can force people to do is be much more physical in their movement, because now you've got all this energy in your hands and feet designed to fight or flight. Mm-hmm. Getting people to go for walks. So you could do meetings where you're walking around so that they're pumping energy through their feet, giving them things that they can do with their hands, because it's about getting rid of all the stuff that's now ready to go. You can't just start punching the person you're sitting next to. Mm. We're designed to do that. So we've got to use the outlets that are available to us to get rid of some of the stress.
Just sticking with that for a moment, because you mentioned fight, flight or freeze, that response. Even experienced cyber professionals feel that, fall victim to that, if you want to put it that way. Is there a way that leaders or teams can train themselves to stay rational, to stay resilient in those very high stress moments?
In the moment, you actually need that state of alertness.
Right.
So at the point, you've got to know where you need the brain to be at its sharpest, because actually that noradrenaline hitting the brain makes you very mentally sharp and you have very strong mental acuity. And that's what you need, because the noradrenaline is going to make you very aware of your environment, but it also makes you very hypersensitive to what's going on around you as well. But you've got to be able to spot those signs, the things that we need the stress for, seeing the danger. We've got to be able to do that. And we're designed to do that when we were facing real danger in our environment in much more primitive times. But in the moment, if there are periods where you know you don't need to be quite so sharp, you can actively bring on the parasympathetic mode by activating the vagus nerve. Now, the vagus nerve is the 10th cranial nerve. It's mm-hmm. the most complex one. It's named after the Latin word for wanderer,
right?
Because it goes everywhere. It literally links the brain with the gut. It has these strands that go everywhere in the system. And it takes messages gut to brain to gut. And the vagus nerve passes through the diaphragm, and the diaphragm is the only muscle that we can control internally. Mm-hmm. And when you breathe in, the diaphragm moves. When you breathe out, the diaphragm moves. The activation of the diaphragm is needed to stimulate the vagus nerve. Now, why is the vagus nerve important? Because it's the king and queen of the parasympathetic mode. Activating the diaphragm becomes critically important. And there's a way to do it called the physiological sigh. So you do these two sharp inhalations and then you do a really long exhalation. Mm-hmm. And if you do this three or four times, at the point where when you don't need to be quite so in a state of alertness, but you're trying to get this balance back into your day, the diaphragm moves, it activates the vagus nerve, then resets the system, and we go into the parasympathetic mode where we can now rest and recover before we then have to switch on the sympathetic fight or flight system again. So it's getting this balance, but you have to force this balance because normally we'd be hunting our animals lying down a lot. But in a state where we're thinking we've got to stay in this alertness all the time, there might be pockets where you can reset the system quickly, recover, rest, then you go back into hyper alertness. And bringing that in needs to be forced. You can't wait for it to happen because we don't do it naturally very easily.
But the good news is it's something that you can practice.
Yes, we can. People call it diaphragmatic breathing, but it's called the physiological sigh. And there's been a lot recently written about it. People have talked about it a lot on various podcasts. It's a wonderful thing to do if you're not sleeping. When we go to bed stressed, we don't sleep very well. Activating the vagus nerve, doing the physiological sigh before sleep actually helps us go into sleep better than if we were just lying awake, panicking that we're not sleeping.
You also talk a lot about how understanding the brain helps us become better leaders. In the context, again, of cybersecurity, where quick decisions and calm under pressure are vital, what can leaders do to keep their own brains and their team's brains functioning at their best? So a little bit of sort of brain hygiene, if you like.
Oh, that's a great question. So brain hygiene for leaders, I love that. Well, leaders can do an awful lot. What leaders tend to do is they tend to drive people to very quick results a lot. And that can actually be a form of violence. Haste is a form of violence. It doesn't allow the brain to do its best thinking. We stick people into a room and we say, brainstorm this problem and come up with an answer. Again, not a great thing to do for a brain that does its best creative work when it's not actively trying to. Leaders need to find a balance between getting people to stretch their brains, so giving people exercises and activities that help them see the world differently, so pushing the brain to explore avenues they perhaps wouldn't have done before. Looking at other industries is a good idea, bringing ideas in that they're already having and connecting, forcing connections between ideas is great. Using brainstorming type environments to select ideas but not generate them, because people will already be having ideas.
Yeah.
But using that time to share ideas and then select the right ones. There's a lot that leaders can be doing to help people think differently, exercise themselves cognitively, encouraging them to do thinking outside of the actual problem and coming to the environment with their ideas and then forcing those connections. Getting people starting meetings on a positive note is a great idea. Celebrating something, start in a really wonderful way, and then people have a great context within to work and they feel that they're able to celebrate. We tend to start meetings with problems or with an agenda and not with celebrating what we can be proud of. And we have such a negatively wired brain that people often come to meetings worrying and being nervous about what might happen, especially if it's a really important one or it's a meeting about a problem or an issue. Cybersecurity, you'll be exploring a lot of quite thorny subjects and quite difficult, high-pressure times. So finding a way to soften that a little bit, starting with what's gone really well and what can we be proud of, and then moving into this is what we're looking at today. Getting people to do little exercises to bond them as a team beforehand, so finding areas of commonality between the team members first helps us understand the team dynamic better. We're more likely to work better together in that way. Doing all the things that perhaps leaders feel they don't have time for.
Okay.
And that's the thing. It's not constant drive to results is not great because it doesn't allow for people to do their best thinking.
It's about creating space, isn't it? Allowing
Absolutely.
Time.
I worked with airline pilots about a year ago and they have to focus on the results. Right. They have to make the plane safe. They told me the first thing they're taught to do is push their chair back, which I love. I talk about silent habits. Mm-hmm. And what leaders need to do is breathe once before responding. Take a pause, take a breath, push your chair back, then respond. You do your best thinking when you've allowed your brain a little bit of space.
I remember very early on in my career, I worked with somebody who used to do just that. And the initial reaction that everybody had to him doing it was that somehow he was disengaging. So I suppose you have to be careful not to push your chair too far back.
No, for too long. No, you can't. Yeah, exactly. No, you can't just leave it back. It has to come back in again. It's momentary, you know, just a small pause. What happens when we react to something? There's a structure inside the brain called the amygdala. And the amygdala activates when anything is a little bit unusual. We call it the fear response, but it's not just the fear. It's anything unusual, anything unpredictable. The amygdala starts to say, something's not quite right, and it protects us. And then the chain reaction works through the body. Then this starts to activate all the hypothalamus, which then is the start of all that endocrine release. And endorphins and adrenaline, they just start to take hold. And to get the amygdala to calm down a little bit, we have to have this pause. And the minute we, even a slight pause, the frontal areas, the prefrontal cortex, the frontal lobe switches on. This gives us the ability to think more rationally. This is where we do all our thinking. Mm-hmm. It's here. But this takes time to come online. It's the newest part of the brain.
Right.
It's the underdeveloped part of the brain in a teenage brain. But even though it's underdeveloped in the teenage brain, it behaves just like a teenager. It's always hungry. It's always tired. So it needs regular reboots and it needs regular feeding. So we need to give it a chance to work at its best. So that needs lots of breaks. So to do our best thinking, we need to give this time to come online and then give it lots of breaks.
Now, you mentioned teams getting together, working in groups, building, I suppose, a degree of trust and collaboration. Neuroscience tells us that trust changes the way our brains respond to threat and certainly collaboration. And in cybersecurity, where mistakes can certainly be very costly, how can leaders build psychological safety so that teams feel supported rather than perhaps fearful?
Psychological safety is one of the hardest things to achieve in any organization. And Amy Edmondson, who coined the phrase, she will say the same thing. Because psychological safety is about creating discomfort in a team. And the reason I say that is if you have a lot of team members who want to belong and want to fit in and want to conform, they're going to be very reluctant to speak out against group norms, group behaviors, group rituals, and they certainly won't challenge up. They won't question the boss. It's very natural for people to do that. We like to feel safe, and so we conform to create that safe environment. Psychological safety is about allowing individuals to challenge those group norms. So it's about allowing individuals to create some tension, some discomfort in the group, to push them to a better way of thinking. And that means creating discomfort. So psychological safety, it sounds counterintuitive, but psychological safety is allowing people to speak out against the group and creating that discomfort. And that is very hard to achieve because people fear for their jobs, their futures, their livelihoods. And most bosses don't want to hear that what's made them successful for years might be now being questioned. But as I always say, all expertise has a sell-by date and we have to be open to revising our knowledge every day. There might be somebody who's new, who sees what we have become blind to, who might actually have a nugget in their heads, some insight that we are just not aware of. It's allowing those people to voice that. And that is psychological safety. It's really hard to do because it's questioning past success, it's questioning past expertise, it's questioning group norms. So how leaders do that, and they need to do it and they need to reward it publicly so other people will do it too. So sometimes this means for a leader to put their ego in their pocket and accept that perhaps they don't have all the answers. And this new person who's been here 2 weeks might just have a golden insight that we need to tap into.
I think that's really good advice because very often those new team joiners, they're totally unencumbered. They don't know about politics of the situation. They know nothing about anything, really. And so capturing that in the early days and encouraging it.
Yes.
Absolutely. Before they become indoctrinated,
Before they become indoctrinated. I used to work for Anderson Consulting, now known as Accenture. And I remember somebody saying to me that there are lots of invisible walls that new people will bump into.
Right.
And those walls that new people bump into need to be questioned sometimes because perhaps they don't need to be there. Perhaps those obstacles that we've put up ourselves, that we say things like we don't have the resources, or we've tried that already, or we haven't got the time, or we've got too many ideas. All the idea killers we hear about and all the reasons for not doing something new people can't see those walls. They don't see those obstacles, those barriers, and they might have something in them that we need to tap into.
I want to move on now to look a little bit more at digital fatigue. Between constant alerts and complex tools that we need to work with, non-stop connectivity, cybersecurity work can be mentally, I don't think anyone would disagree with this, it can be mentally draining. What does brain science tell us about managing cognitive overload in particular and maintaining focus in such high demand environments?
It's so difficult in a world with endless distraction. We have got information coming at us from all directions, and we simply don't have the brain power to deal with it all. So the brain selects what it wants to focus on based on what's important to that person. So what's important for me may not be important for you.
Right.
We have to select. The brain has to actively select. This is called selective attention. Selective attention also makes us blind to the things that we're choosing not to focus on. And you might pick up something that I am blind to.
Right.
So your selective attention might help me see what I can't see. So it's really important to surround yourself with people who disagree with you, who see the world differently, because their blindness will be different to our blindness. But in a world of constant overload and focus, I hear so many people saying that they've got ADHD or their children have got ADHD. Now, sometimes that's absolutely right. But sometimes, and I would say a lot of the time, people haven't got ADHD, but they've just weakened their attentional muscle.
Right.
And the attentional muscle weakens when we allow ourselves to be constantly distracted. Now, when we're constantly distracted, the brain rewards itself for distraction because historically, imagine you're walking through the bush, you needed to be distracted by a sudden noise or a sudden movement. So the brain said, "You're great, you've seen that, you've seen that. Here's a hit of dopamine." And dopamine is released in anticipation of a reward. So the brain loves being distracted. It rewards itself for being distracted and it craves distraction. So in a world of technology, this is great news, but it's bad news for the brain because the more we get distracted, the more we'll get distracted, the less we'll focus. Now, you can train your brain to focus again. And in cybersecurity, you need to focus and you need to spend some time being able to focus and not getting distracted. So those moments of focus, you need to remove distractions from your world. And if you find that you just can't get focused, there's a technique called the Pomodoro technique, which is named after the Italian for tomato because the timers are in the shape of a tomato.
Right.
And you time yourself at intervals to focus. If you're really struggling with focus, you do 3-minute bursts timed. The alarm goes off. Then you give yourself a 30-second break. Then you do it again. And then after 5 rounds of this, you give yourself a 15-minute break and come back to it. Over time, you can increase that focus, that time, and you can take it to about 20 minutes. And we can learn to get that muscle going again if we train the brain to do it. But the brain has trained itself to be distracted. But we need to focus. Cybersecurity requires focus. Now, in cybersecurity as well, people will be spotting certain things and other people will be spotting other things.
Right.
They just study in the scanners in the airport security where people looking for guns would see the guns, but they'd miss the knives.
Right.
People looking for knives would see the knives but miss the guns. So we see what we want to see and we don't see what we don't want to see. So creating a diverse workforce is really important. People who see the world differently, working together is key because of the blindness that we have. And then training people, this focus is also key because if there is a chance to be distracted, the brain will take it.
Okay. And also, I suppose, outside of the workplace, because if you look at pretty much anybody, they will have a number of different devices that they're constantly checking, playing with.
Yes.
To have just one phone is, well, that's unusual these days. You've usually got a number of other things and you're constantly getting stimuli from these different phones, which when you talk about the things you're talking about now with the brain...
We just don't have the brain power to deal with it all. Ironically, the world we've designed for ourselves, we are now no longer designed for. And this is why people are struggling. This is why we're living in a very superficial Instagram-fed world where we've got curated perfection, where people will take 1,000 pictures to choose one, where people can't live without their phone. So I always say to people, can you leave your house, let the front door slam behind you, walk 10 paces down the road, and then you realize you've left your phone at home? Can you keep walking? If you can't keep walking, there's a problem because we should theoretically be able to survive without a phone, even for a short time. But we feel that we're so addicted to this technology now. And the people designing the technology know this. Famously, they haven't given their own kids their own technologies. And this is the big problem, is that one of the things I do say is, please do not allow your children to sit on devices. It's so bad for their brains. They're young, growing brains. They need to be outside playing. They need to be learning all the things that we're designed for: sport, physical exercise, teamwork, learning to lose, learning to fail, that will then take them into adulthood in a healthy way. But sitting on devices and not learning interpersonal connection then end up with a workforce that haven't cut their teeth on debate and being able to hear things they don't want to hear. That's a problem now, because what do? We just simply say, I don't want to hear you, and we cancel. And that's not good either, because debate is where the brain strengthens itself. Difference of opinion, we've got to be able to handle that more and more in a world where we're just deciding, and algorithms are feeding this. We're deciding only to get what we want rather than also get what we don't want.
It's about balance, isn't it?
Always about balance.
Yeah. Now, cybersecurity evolves at a pretty lightning speed, and change can trigger resistance and indeed anxiety. So from your work in neuroscience, how can leaders help teams embrace change? I'm not just talking about managing it. I'm talking about truly embracing it in a way that supports brain health and increases motivation.
You're not going to want to hear this, but the brain actually can't embrace change.
Okay.
It doesn't love change, because change represents something new and something scary new. Novelty, the brain will switch on to.
Okay.
So the word new, the brain actually really likes. It thinks, oh, I get distracted by the next shiny thing. But if it's too new, the brain then starts to panic. The phrase change management, which I actually hate, is something that the brain can't manage. And I always say you can't manage the unmanageable, because it doesn't work that way in the brain. But the brain is predictive. It sits in darkness. It sits in your head. And it's receiving sensory data, sense data it's called, all the time. And the brain has to be able to work this data out and then tell us what to do about it at lightning speed. And in order to do that, it needs to know what it's getting. If it doesn't know what it's getting, it goes into a state called experiential blindness. It doesn't know. And the neurons start to panic. So anything unexpected, unpredictable, changing is a problem for a brain that sits in darkness. So what leaders need to understand is that if you want the brain to accept anything new or different, we need to make it new, but not too new. Mm-hmm. And this is what Apple has done very cleverly. If you look at the evolution of the iPhone over the years, you look at every device lined up. If you look at the first device versus now the iPhone 17, it's really different.
Yes.
But if you look at the incremental changes over time, it's actually been new enough for us to spend another €1,000, £1,000, $1,000 on a new handset, but not so new. It represents whole new technology. So you need to have links with the past, associations with the familiar. Ridley Scott, when he was pitching for Alien, knew that he had to make his idea new, but not too new. So he pitched Alien as Jaws in space. Because people knew Jaws, they knew space.
Yeah.
So it went. So people need to have a foothold, a little bit of a foothold in the past. So the brain can't take huge jumps. It can only take small steps. So small steps is very good, and the brain learns to adjust. So as leaders are getting people to adjust to new and different technologies or requirements, it's making it easy enough for the brain to handle in small incremental steps. Ultimately, it will represent a big disruption, but all disruptions are the result of small steps. The brain's very good at handling these small, constant adjustments in the world. I don't know if you sail, Steve. Do you sail? So if you're at the helm, you'll know on a boat, the helm is never still.
No.
And it's not like in a car where you're doing this more deliberately, but on the helm, you're constantly moving.
Right.
Because the water, the winds, everything around us is changing. So we have to imagine ourselves as the helm and never still, always constantly adjusting. The brain is really good at this. So finding small ways to get teams to adjust incrementally, getting them to be part of these incremental changes, making them feel that it's something they can choose, they can control. We hate being out of control as well. The brain is an utter control freak. Telling people they have to change won't cut it.
Right.
We hate that. We hate being told what to do. But creating environments where they feel they want to take a bit of a risk or try something new, but small, new with a little N, not a big N, and making sure that the movement is all in the right direction, that's what we can do. And that's what leaders can help their teams do much better.
And I suppose it's about encouraging them to do that as well, isn't it? And empowering them.
Yes.
just so that they get used to suggesting different ways of doing things and gradually move the team themselves.
Exactly. Or the team learns to self-direct.
Right.
We love autonomy. We love freedom. We love agency. So giving the team something that they can try that is a bit of a no-brainer, that they think, I can do that. I can do that. Some psychologists call it habit stacking. You stack new habits onto old ones. And so it doesn't feel like it's too much of a thing for the brain to handle. It's new, but not too new. It's new, but it's got a link with the old. That's the way you move it forward. You know, people will say to me, oh, you know, I need to lose weight, or I need to exercise more. Those are big statements.
Right.
But if you said to the brain, take the stairs every now and then, I can do that. I can do that. I can put a few more vegetables on my plate instead of potatoes or whatever it is, or bread. We can handle the small stuff. It's the big stuff that the brain struggles with.
Yeah, I'm not very good at some of those. I must admit, chocolate's my thing. So I'll go through phases where I've got loads of chocolate in the house. And then
It's dark chocolate, you're fine.
Well,
that's okay.
But I'll get to a point there where I'll think to myself, no, I can't do this. And the only way I can stop myself is by actually chucking it all out.
So out of sight, out of mind.
Keep it in the shed.
Keep it in the shed. Well, you'll know it's there. Yeah, but dark chocolate, you're okay. It has an amino acid that boosts serotonin, and serotonin makes us feel happy, so...
85% is my favourite.
Yeah, well, actually, very good for you.
Anyone listening who wants to send me some?
Yeah. There's a hint. My address is...
Swiss dark 85%.
Very good. That's not a bad habit.
Let's move now, Helena, to talking about something that people, I suppose, in the industry have talked about for many years, which is this term, which actually I don't like, but it's very common. It's called the human firewall. And it's all to do with people. We often say that people are the weakest link in cybersecurity. But they can also be, and in my experience anyway, the strongest defense. What does neuroscience reveal about how to design communication, culture, training, and awareness that can truly engage the human brain in protecting information?
Gosh, that's a huge question. Human beings are quite fallible and they're quite flawed, because we have a brain that is not optimized for making the best decisions. It's optimized for making the best decisions for me, but often not for the collective. And when it comes to information security, again, it's not really optimized. If the brain is tired or hungry, it won't make great decisions. So I think coming back to basics for the brain is really important. Keeping the brain in its most healthy state is probably the best thing that cybersecurity professionals can do. And that means keeping the body very active. So the brain needs oxygenation. And you can get oxygenation through the physiological sigh. That's a really important thing to do. But the brain needs a lot more oxygenation. So short bursts of cardiovascular exercise or activity really helps the brain think better. You increase your cognitive powers much better that way. Helping the brain to slow down. So taking a break away from what you're doing and allowing yourself thinking time is really important. Allowing debate and discussion, so people are able to cut their teeth on difference and difference of opinion. So we see information in a certain way, but we will always have our own lens through which we filter it, the information we're looking at. It's always good to explore how other people are seeing the same thing and then triangulate that, converge on some agreed point where you're merging a lot of different opinions.
One of the things that I've always found works is to try, wherever possible, to make things as personal as possible.
Yes.
The brain then can make the link. They can relate better to it rather than providing a policy or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Any information we receive, if it's very factual and very dense in data, the brain really struggles with that.
Right.
Now, we have this thing called the picture superiority effect. So the human brain can process pictures, I think it's 60,000 times more quickly than words.
Right.
So where possible, when you're handling data and information, it's always good to try and find a visual representation, even if it's a graph, or even if it's using color to separate text out, so the brain can process that information more quickly. That's really important. And if you want people to remember information, yes, you're right. A personal link, a story that's attached to it. So the amygdala that I talked about that fires when we see anything uncertain, it's an emotional radar. So the amygdala sits at the end of the hippocampus, which stores a lot of our memory, especially personal memory. And the amygdala and the hippocampus work together to help us encode information of an emotional, personal nature.
Right.
Those memories that we encode that have a higher emotional component are much easier for us to remember. So in order to get people to remember better any information, it's always good to link anything to a story or make it personal. Then people store it differently and then recall it better.
Elena, lots of very good advice. We've covered a tremendous amount of ground. I'm sure that anybody listening to this who's interested in looking at it in a little bit more detail will be pleased to know you've actually written a book that people can pick up called Why We Do What We Do. Now, presumably that's available on Amazon and all
Yes, and it's been translated. And I wrote it as COVID was erupting around us. So I think there's another book that should be written now, Why We Did What We Did, or Why We Do What We Do Now, might be interesting. Because we have emerged, or what we should do, yes, what we should do next. But we have learned a lot about ourselves. COVID taught us a lot, for better and worse, about ourselves as a species. And also we're living in a different world now where things do feel different. And I think some of the talks I give now, I'm covering material that aren't in the book because the world moved on very quickly and we were seeing things happen around us that I thought, oh, that's going to be interesting for people to hear, and also helping people through times that were really difficult. But the book has 12 chapters. It's a guide to the brain for non-scientists. Mm-hmm. And it bridges the organizational corporate world with neuroscience and psychology and behavioral science, behavioral economics, to help people understand practically how to get the best out of their brain and the brains of the people they're living with or working with. So I'm hoping it's a useful guide for those who want to read it.
I think it is. I've read it.
Thank
I did
you.
Actually start out by reading things in the way I normally read, which is skimming. But I found myself being dragged into some of those chapters, and it does help to just give a little bit of context as to why we actually do what we do. So, Helena, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISF member or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org, or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.